Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to our Action Research Podcast, created by the HEAR Lab team at the University of Houston. The HEAR Lab is the hub for engaged action research, and the mission of the lab is to build the capacity of scholars to create and disseminate collaborative, accessible, anti-racist research that centers community and fuels social change. Through hosting different activities such as walk and learns, webinars, or disseminating one-page research briefs, the team hopes to amplify research beyond articles and connect scholars to one another. Research should be done to create an impact, and by hosting this podcast, the hope is to have more awareness around anti-racist research approaches, as well as seeing how research goes beyond articles to connect to practice and policy. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to our Action Research Podcast, created by the HEAR Lab team at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. The HEAR Lab is the hub for engaged action research, and the mission of the lab is to build the capacity of scholars to create and disseminate collaborative, accessible, anti-racist research that centers community and fuels social change. Through this podcast, we aim to amplify the community-engaged research methodologies of various teams and how it has a potential to create a bright future full of transformation. The podcast allows researchers to share their work and go beyond traditional academic articles or textbooks to link with practical applications and policy development to have a greater impact. Today, we welcome Dr. Arlene Bugsted, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Social Work at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. She has more than 15 years of social work practice experience in various environments. Arlene's practice and research interests are in the intersection of school-based mental health, community well-being, and immigration. She is particularly interested in decolonized and culturally grounded approaches to social work practice and mental health service provision. Our second guest is Dr. Jody Berger-Cardoso, who also has 15 years of clinical experience working with immigrant populations and currently works as an associate professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. Dr. Berger-Cardoso works with several humanitarian organizations that focus on providing legal and mental health services to immigrants, unaccompanied minor youth, and refugees that have experienced trauma. Recently, she received a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to examine the effects of immigration enforcement on mental health outcomes of Latino youth. So let's jump right in and hear about all the work you two are doing.
Thank you, Anil. Thank you so much for inviting us. My name is Dr. Arlene Bugsted, and my colleague, Dr. Berger-Cardoso, and I would like to share a little bit about several projects that we have been working on for a number of years. We really want to start out by describing who unaccompanied immigrant children are, as they really are the prime focus of our research.
So unaccompanied minors are individuals or children, adolescents, young people who migrate to the United States without being accompanied by one or both of their parents. Sometimes they come with extended family, sometimes they come with siblings, sometimes they come with community members, but by definition, they don't come with one or both of their parents. And so we have focused our work on unaccompanied minors in the Houston area, primarily because Houston receives the largest percentage of unaccompanied minors in the country. And there are many challenges and barriers that unaccompanied minors face when they migrate to the United States. And we've been interested in trying to alleviate some of the mental health symptoms that they experience as a result of these challenges.
So much of our work has really been centered around a grassroots organization that was founded by Dr. Berger-Cardoso and some of her colleagues at Save the Children. It is a fully operating grassroots organization that has been operational for the last 10 years, since 2014, and it's called the Central American Minors Working Group. We are based in Houston. We meet once a month. Primarily, we are a group of service providers, from pediatricians to attorneys to mental health professionals to caseworkers to community organizers. And through our work with the Central American Miners Working Group, we've really become privy to understanding some of the strengths and also some of the challenges that newcomer immigrant families face, and particularly families who are integrating unaccompanied children, children who have migrated by themselves back into their family unit. And this grassroots work that we've been doing really has helped us see the need for specific interventions that focus on these communities and the attachment disruptions that they've experienced, and also the immense need that we have for community work and policy work.
So I'm going to jump in here as you both start talking about all the amazing work you're doing. And one project has led to several projects. And Dr. Berger-Cardoso, it sounds like you have been in this work for a good amount of time, founding and having a grassroots organization. As you both talk about attachment and mental health of unaccompanied minors, how does this research that you both are doing in this work contribute to social justice?
Well, unaccompanied minors are a really vulnerable group of children. They're vulnerable for many reasons. One, many of these children and adolescents and young people are escaping community violence in countries with severe poverty. And so by virtue of growing up in an environment that is a deficit of resources in order to grow and develop healthfully, oftentimes these kids experience significant challenges attending school, seeing the doctor. Many of them don't have consistent nutrition and would be considered by U.S. standards food insecure. And so many, many children in the communities where we see high migration, many of them have experienced ongoing challenges in their development. A lot of these children have also experienced and been exposed to pretty significant trauma. In our work, we show as high as 60 to 70% of unaccompanied minors or even immigrant children exposed to very significant high rates of trauma. This can be trauma from within the community through gang violence and state-sponsored violence, but it also can be interpersonal or interfamilial violence that kids experience. For unaccompanied minors, many of their parents are migrants themselves. And so as is typical in Latin America, usually one person migrates. And then after a period of time, after settlement of that migrant, other people come. You know, many of these kids are left behind in the countries of origin with caregivers that are not their parents. And when they migrate to the United States, they experience the challenges and the horrors of the migration process. There's lots of data from Amnesty International and other non-governmental organizations that suggest that as high as 60% of girls, for example, are sexually assaulted in the migration process. And so the migration process as it is leaves young people very unprotected. And then they arrive to the United States and they're processed through immigration and border control. And so, you know, then they're placed in detention, and that environment also places them at risk. So these are unaccompanied minors or immigrant kids, even who migrate with their parents, are often a very vulnerable group of kids. And in our work, we've really seen the evidence of that vulnerability in both how they respond to our trauma questionnaires, but also in the challenges that they continue to face in school and in their community.
And it should be noted as well that children who migrate in this context are fleeing violence, they're fleeing trauma, but this migration journey itself is incredibly traumatic. It's incredibly expensive. It costs to get from Guatemala. Guatemalan youth are the largest. It's nearly 50% of the unaccompanied children who have arrived in the U.S. over the past 5 years. Nearly 50% have been from the country of Guatemala. So that is really not that far away in terms of if we were to take an airplane. But these youth are coming from on trains, on buses, on foot in different parts. And the last thing that I understood was it costs about $12,000 to get from the southern Mexican border to the northern Mexican border, where they will turn themselves into Border Patrol to be processed as unaccompanied children. As Dr. Berger Cardoso mentioned, they are then immediately put into a detention facility through the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Those detention facilities, this is a whole big social justice issue. And in particular, depending, we can look at the statistics of how long it takes a child to get out of that detention center. But during certain presidential administrations, that time that children sit in detention and wait is more than double what it is during other presidential administrations. And so what we heard in many of the interviews that we did with young people was the trauma that they experienced being in when they're in Border Patrol protection. They go to these places called hieleras, or ice boxes, where they're freezing and they have no anything. Their shoelaces are taken from them. And then they're placed into detention facilities where they may get some clothing and things, and they wait, and they have very little communication with their family members. And then when they're reunified, often the societal expectation is that everything's perfect now. Look, you made it to the United States. Now you're with your family. And that just isn't the reality, because there is a great deal of injustice and oppression that our immigrant families face in the United States. And that doesn't stop when a child is reunified. And not to mention, many of these children are being reunified after a period of long separation. So there may be a completely different family structure. Their extended family is no longer around. And that community that they knew in their home country, whether or not it may have been unsafe, it was still a community. And in the United States, we know that migrants often have to become very isolated out of fear of immigration enforcement, out of fear of some of their neighbors not being friendly to them, the xenophobia that they experience. So this reunification period is not as happy as we may assume it might be.
And I'm going to have you go back, and then I'll ask you another question too. You talk about xenophobia. Just in case listeners don't understand what that is, I want to make sure everyone is on the same page.
Yeah, thank you. So xenophobia is defined as an undue fear of individuals from other countries.
Mm-hmm. And as you talk about that that undue fear, you also talk about the different family structures, the different community, the isolation, right? The experiences, right? And I'm getting really passionate because this hits close to home. My wife is half Guatemalan, half Salvadorian, so Central American. And I really think about the process. So let's dig into, what's the research that you guys are doing? You talk about the traumas, you talk about their experiences. What are you trying to find out? And then how is that then connected to influence policy and legislation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think what's interesting is that we weren't actually trying to figure anything out. We were part of this working group, right? And because we're members of the community, because Dr. Bustad and I are very passionate about immigrant rights and the rights of children in general. And so we're part of this work group. We meet once a month, and we're listening to our colleagues in mental health clinics and our colleagues in the schools and our colleagues in the legal community, our colleagues in the healthcare system. And we're all trying to sort of piece together, what is it that children need and what is their access? And that is a very important piece to this, because as you know, in Texas, its policies are in place that are largely anti-immigrant. And so there's not a lot of access to mental health services, to physical health services. And in many cases, kids are met with a lot of opposition, even with school enrollment. And so you know, in this working group, we're meeting with people and we're figuring out what they're experiencing. And we're trying to kind of put the pieces together so that at the community level, we can advocate in the schools, in the legal community, in the mental health clinics for what unaccompanied minors or immigrant kids in general, immigrant families need in the Houston community. And so through those conversations, we started to really learn about the challenges that kids face when they reunify with parents and caregivers that they don't know. And so, you know, a lot of times the parent migrates when the child is very young, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. And so the working memory of that child really doesn't have a lot of composition related to experiences with the parent. A lot of the caregiving has been with other people in their countries of origin, grandparents, aunts, uncles, other community members. And so when kids migrate, there's a grieving process because they leave behind those relationships and those people and those communities. And they come to the United States and they're reunified with their parents, with whom they should feel really elated to know and be with. But there's a distance and there's a unfamiliarity. And then oftentimes there's a lot of cognitive dissonance. So while kids understand their parents had to migrate because they had no other choice, they also feel the hurt and the abandonment and the loneliness of being left behind for so long. And so we started to hear the stories of kids reunifying with parents and families disrupting, meaning kids leaving the family even after they were, you know, released from detention and placed with a parent or placed with a caregiver. That relationship was really strained. And we started to ask ourselves, like, well, how do we help families prepare and heal so that this disruption doesn't cause kids to be living in the street or cause kids to be vulnerable and more apt to being trafficked? So we started to ask these questions. And we start and Dr. Buchstadt and I started to realize that there were really no interventions that target reunification period for parents and children who have been separated by migration. There are interventions about how to help facilitate reunification after parental incarceration. And there were interventions about how to facilitate reunification when kids are reunified following foster care. But there wasn't any evidence to speak to how these experiences were similar or different to kids when they reunified with their parents following a migration-related separation. And when we look at like just the sheer numbers between 2014 and 2023, there were 40,906 unaccompanied minors reunified with a caregiver in the Harris County area.
Just Harris County.
So we started to ask ourselves, like, this is a big problem. And we know that, like, parent-child relationship is a predictor for both mental health challenges in the parents and in the children. But it's also a factor of resilience. When you can strengthen that caregiving relationship, then it increases resilience and it increases tolerance and improves emotional regulation. So that's kind of how this work started. It wasn't like we had a question and we asked the community, hey, can you give us, did you think this will work? It was like, we are part of this grassroots organization. We're really concerned about the level of trauma of children coming into our country and their lack of access to affordable treatment. And we want them to register in schools and we want them to heal from whatever experiences they carry with them from their countries of origin. And this just happened to be one aspect that we thought was really troublesome, that there wasn't any evidence to really teach clinicians or teach community health workers or teach teachers about how to regulate and how to manage some of that reunification stress that we were observing in the community.
We learned a great deal of this through a series of dyadic interviews that we conducted with children and their mothers who had been separated due to migration. the focus of those interviews was really just to learn what their experiences were, what was going well for them, and what their challenges were. And what very much came out were these attachment disruptions, multiple attachment disruptions with multiple loved ones across multiple developmental periods for these young people. And what also really stuck out when we began to look into the attachment-focused intervention research, not only were there not interventions that focused on the immigrant context, but there were no attachment-focused interventions that focused on adolescents and parents, even generally. And we know that that's just a challenging time for development and a challenging time for many families regardless. And when you add in trauma, family separation, that can really provide more challenges. Another thing that we learned in our interviews was that it was really important. Mental health services are super inaccessible, and they're particularly inaccessible for families who don't have access to insurance, for families, you know, who may or may not, based on their work and other life schedules, be able to get to, you know, once a week in-person therapy sessions. All of the families indicated that therapy would be beneficial. There was no indication of stigma around mental health. The parents and the children understood, at least all of the ones in our interviews, they were well aware of the concerns that they had. They were well aware of how trauma was manifesting, and they wanted help, and they felt like talking with people about things and problem solving would be really beneficial to them. And so what we worked out with the folks who were in these interviews and with our community advisory people through CAM was working on an intervention that would be delivered by people in the community, like promotoras. And that is the work that we are kind of continuing through this really long. When we tell you how long this process is, you might be like, oh my gosh, really? Community-based work takes a really long time, but it's also incredibly fruitful. We've had a lot of projects and have really developed so many key relationships through this process.
I think it's really special that the work that you all are doing is not, right? I think there's so many assumptions of where researchers get their questions, but your work is truly grounded in the community's experience. What was going on, and how do we understand experiences and then address the challenges? Whereas so many times research is seen as what, like, let me find a problem, let me create a question around it. So I just want to highlight how special your work is in the work that you both are doing.
Yeah, if we told you, like, we started off this process thinking one intervention would be the way. We went through a whole year-long process to
during
look at the adaptation
COVID, during
of that
the
intervention.
Crux of COVID.
During COVID. To get to the end and realize that the intervention was not suitable for the population. And it was like we had a choice. We could keep pushing it and pushing it, or we could step back and be like, okay, we may have been wrong about this. And in fact, we were wrong about it. Now we're building an intervention that's not delivered by social workers. It's delivered by community healthcare members. And that actually helps reduce the accessibility issue for families that don't have health insurance, because you don't need a trained LMSW or LCSW to give those interventions. And so it really is, you know, community-based research, you really have to be in love with
the process,
what you care about. Because if you're outcome based at all, it's really not a good use of academic time. You have to really be passionate about what you're doing. And like I said, we went a whole year and realized, oh man, we spun this all wrong. We've got this all wrong. And we had to like go through another year long process of getting pilot data and trying to figure out a different avenue for it. So even though we were wrong, we knew that the premise behind the grant, which is that we really need interventions to target this reunification period so that we can improve the attachment distress in these families. It was just our approach was too high level. It was too clinical. Eiffel Tower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So we had to bring it. We had to ask our community, man, how did we screw this up? How did we mess this up? Where did we get it wrong? And they told us and we listened and then we, you know, circled back and did it again. And so I think like where Dr. Fustad and I's work, I think has been really critical is in the ways that we use this work across multiple levels, right? So you could look at what we've talked about today and you could assume that Dr. Fustad and I are micro focus, that we are only interested in developing intervention or we're intervention researchers. But that would actually not be an accurate description of Dr. Fustad and I. In fact, neither one of us has really done intervention research until this particular project. We have multiple projects at multiple levels and we intervene in we participate at multiple levels. Dr. Fustad runs the Central American Minors Work Group now. I oftentimes testify in asylum and refugee hearings where I talk about the effects of family separation on child development and why it's important to keep families together. So we're testifying at the policy level. We're using our community engaged research and we're using our findings to inform how people think about the policies and procedures that they put in place, hopefully in an effort to not implement policies and procedures that will directly traumatize children, like, for example, zero tolerance. So we really are, she and I work really across the gamut of, at the individual level, at the community level, and at the policy level. And I think that we do that because at heart, Dr. Fustad and I, we really care about immigrant families. That has always been what drives our work. And even the ego that is typically associated with some of, academic research, we really try and step away from, like, how we got it all wrong and we had to start again. And, we really try to be joining with our partners and not sort of a top-down approach. And I think that speaks to the sort of like anti-oppression, social justice lens. Like it also kind of undoes the patriarchy of the system. If you're top down and you're telling people what they need and what they want, it's very different than allowing them to tell you what they need and want. And even if that's not super convenient, you have to go with where people are and what they need. And so that's really, I think, been what makes Dr. Fustad and I's approach to this work a bit unique, is that we're not in a rush for the outcome. We really care about families and we really want to partner with the people that we work with.
And it's giving me chills, right? Just to hear all the amazing outcomes, right? We're talking about not being outcome focused, but there's so much that is coming out of the work that you all are doing. So I have to highlight that too. And then on the other end of this, right, I'm going to drill down to how are we making sure both of you are community focused in the community? How are we making sure that what you're finding, the interventions that you're creating, is also disseminated and talked to with the community?
Yeah, so we'll go back to, and our primary avenue has been the Central American Minors Working Group and our other colleagues who are a part of that. So UNICEF, they're with their Child Friendly Cities Initiative. Houston was the first U.S. City for that particular initiative. And so we've been very fortunate that fortunate and hardworking that we have a big audience, a big membership. And so we have through that connected with folks who are contractors with their detention centers. We have contacts with UNICEF. who has disseminated not only our work, but our working group is the longest standing working group focused on immigrant children. And we are the only one that doesn't have specific organizational backing. And so I think those are several avenues that we really lean on our partners in the Central American Minors Working Group to give us feedback, but also to work with us to make connections. And so we also have this podcast, and we also have several publications, which we would be happy to send to anyone you know, who doesn't have an institutional login. We would be happy to share those. We have several book chapters, several academic publications that have come out of this work. And we're currently working on a pilot project with this exact data that we've been talking about. And we are connected with an organization, the most amazing organization in Houston, La Unidad Once. It is a group, a grassroots mutual aid organization formed with immigrants, for immigrants in our community. And so those are different ways that we have engaged our community and like disseminated the research, both in most more formal ways, but in less formal ways. And we certainly are open to feedback, right, about other avenues. Additionally, as I mentioned, Dr. Berger Cardoso does quite a bit of testimony. And we also are a part of a variety of coalitions at the national level as well that are really working on policy issues, such as in the Backlog Coalition, which looks at special immigrant juvenile status, which is kind of a special kind of visa status for children who have experienced severe abuse or neglect. There is an incredible backlog. And we have had some success pushing some legislation through. And we are working on trying to get child-only immigration courts. That has passed, I believe, in New York State. But it is something that is being pushed at a larger level so that children can have their own space for immigration court. But realistically, we need full and comprehensive immigration reform and like a whole revolution in this space.
Yeah, and we need to hold the United States responsible for the fact that they're still the only Western country that has refused to sign the UN Convention of the Child. So Arlene and I are fierce advocates, both for the rights of immigrant families, but also in particular for the rights of children across the globe.
I am lucky to be sitting here with two rock star scholars, researchers, community members. So I would love for each of you to take just about 30 seconds and just do one action step that people should take after hearing all the work that you all are doing. So I'll hand off the mic to you all, and then I'll wrap it up after that.
Get involved in local coalitions around an issue that you're passionate about: immigrants, children, folks who are unhoused, whatever that issue area is. I will plug immigration. We need change. We cannot wait until tomorrow. It needs to happen. Get involved in local coalitions. Some of this work seems really, really overwhelming and really big, and it really is big, but there are so, so many people who also see this need and are working hard at it, and we can build it together. Join some local coalitions. I'd be happy to share some with you if you need.
Yeah, and I would say, I guess my closing point is, at the end of the day, I firmly believe, and I think the people around me believe, both, you know, opposite ends of the political spectrum, that children deserve the right to grow up in a safe, loving, fulfilling environment that's gonna help them develop into, you know, healthy, strong, active, and participating adults. And whether we agree, you know, about politics or not, many of the children that come into this country, they have desperate need for safety and for security and for food, just the basic human right of survival. And I just ask that even for those of us that get really fixed in our viewpoints, approach this issue with curiosity. Learn about it. Learn about it from the people who are surviving it, because they are the ones that have the stories that will really make or break the way you feel about a certain, political opinion. Like, listen to the stories of people before you make a decision and understand the complexity of the situation. And as Dr. Bustad said, once you get informed and you understand from the people who are living those issues in their everyday lives, then get involved. If you're a social worker and you're thinking, man, I really want to do this work, I really want to be involved in immigration research, especially if you're coming from the communities that we're talking about today, please email us, talk to us, come get a PhD, because we really need more people from the community with lived experience talking about the work. And we are happy to share the knowledge and the access and the opportunities for other people to be in these spaces as well.
Absolutely. Well, I can't thank the both of you enough, right? And Dr. Cardoso, I've met you, worked with you. Dr. Bustad, I missed the opportunity while you were at U of H, but I'm glad to have been able to put this podcast together. This is your host, Anil Arora, and our amazing guests, Redefining Research by Making It Fun, signing off and living the dream. The HERE Lab team is here to connect with scholars and community to amplify voices in research. We look forward to connecting with listeners through their reflection and conversations. If you see public impact scholarship occurring in your community, tag us. Let us know. Stay in touch or share your thoughts by tagging us on Twitter at #GCSWHERELab. Rate our show, leave us a review, and subscribe so you can learn about all things HERELab and can cultivate change in research procedures, policy, and impact practice. This is your host, Anil Arora, signing off. Living the dream.